Hi, everybody. Alonzo here. Listen, before we get into this episode, I just want to make a quick announcement about how Who Shot You episodes are going to be going for the immediate future. Normally, we record in a studio together, but due to recent events, we're all recording remotely in the safety of our own homes. So this means for the first time, we are heavily relying on new technology to record these episodes. And, you know, sometimes technology can fail you. It did in the recording of the episode you're about to listen to. You will notice some drastic inconsistencies in the audio quality as the show progresses. We apologize for this. Please bear with us as we continue to iron out all the kinks with our new online remote recording process. All of our future episodes will not sound the same as they did when we recorded in studio, but we are doing our best to bring you the highest audio quality possible. That's it. That's the announcement. This is a really fun episode with director Barry Sonnenfeld. You should totally check out his book. Enjoy.
Careful, man. There's a beverage here, huh?
Does anybody here know how many times I've had to watch Funny Lady?
I'm going to get that gun of mine, and I'm going to change you from a rooster to a hen with one shot.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Alonzo Duralde. We're not in the studio this week. We are all in our separate germ-free little pods doing this show remotely, but damn it, we're doing this show. Joining me today, our producer and film festival programmer, Drea Clark. Drea, what's good?
Hello, Alonzo. This is curious times. Yes, I love that I feel like I'm coming to you from a bunker. I'm on day 6 of not seeing another human in my own sweet self-quarantine. So what is good for me is even though, you know, my Midwestern Minnesotan roots keep me from being super woo-woo, I have been using my gratitude app and trying to keep a gratitude journal. So at night, I write things that I'm thankful and grateful for, which helps me, keep all of the shadows at bay to a certain amount. So I'm sure there are more practiced people in the art of woo-woo who could give you better insight, but I'm enjoying my foray into gratitude journaling. Also, the fact that it's an app is making me feel very young and hip. And there's nothing there's nothing a lady in a bunker wants more than feeling young and hip.
Well, that sounds, I suppose it is, we'll put that in the self-care quality.
Sure.
So I'll allow it. We are delighted to have with us today legendary filmmaker, cinematographer. His films include The Addams Family and Addams Family Values, Men in Black, Get Shorty, the author of the new memoir, Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother, Memoirs of a Neurotic Filmmaker. Barry Sonnenfeld, what's good?
Woo-woo!
Hi, Alonzo. Hi, Drea. Well, what's good is, although I am self-quarantining as well with my wife, we live in Telluride, Colorado, and we have views of all the mountains that are on the front of the Coors can and other mountains, and it's supposed to snow tomorrow. So although we don't ski, it will be beautiful. So I'm grateful for that. Is that acceptable?
Yes.
Absolutely. I hope your larders are stocked.
Oh, yes. We're in fine shape. We've got many refrigerators here in Telluride.
Perfect.
And all that snow. The world is your refrigerator.
Well, yeah, but you don't want to eat the yellow snow.
That's true.
Already with the sage advice, we're in the first 2 minutes of the show.
I know. Right. Hey, Alonzo, what's good with you?
Well, I'll tell you, I've actually been self-quarantining for about 10 days now because Dave White came down with a sinus infection before things got really hairy in the world. So I got an early jump on the let's never leave the apartment and see no one thing. So I have to say that this weirdly does kind of dovetail into the gratitude thing in that I'm taking pleasure and appreciating small things that I would have very easily taken for granted before. And I'd say foremost among those things are the stash of Girl Scout cookies that I have in the kitchen. I am parceling them out to myself in a very stingy and miserly way to make them stretch out. But I'll tell you, I used to not give them a second thought, and now it's like every so often during the day, I'm like, a Girl Scout cookie would really hit the spot right now, and it just makes the whole day.
That is the quintessential easy pleasure.
It doesn't take much. It's not so difficult. But yeah, I'll tell you, when I can't just waltz out of the house and go on a snack run, so glad they're there. So hey, everybody, this is a Retro Rewind episode. We're climbing in the time machines and going back to 1964 to discuss Stanley Kubrick's great classic hallowed black comedy, Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. We'll talk about Barry's bomb new book, and we've also got our staff picks. But first, we'll be doing the past tense version of our It a Dick segment with What a Dick. That's short for Was This Important? Do I Care? We're going to read some various headlines from 1964 and answer those questions. Was this important? Do I care? And Dre is going to kick us off.
I am. So just at the top of 1964, the same month as the release of Dr. Strangelove, actress Elizabeth Taylor sued singer Eddie Fisher, the father of Carrie Fisher, in order to marry actor Richard Burton. This was like the big couple story of the time and of many times after. They really hung on to that title for a decade. Taylor and Burton had an extramarital affair during the making of Cleopatra. At the time, Taylor was married to Eddie Fisher. Burton was married to actress Sybil Christopher. The affair caused quite a stir after the publication of a paparazzi photo of the two of them on a yacht together. They were condemned by the Vatican for their erotic vagrancy, and I am disappointed to this day no one has made a film called Erotic Vagrancy. That did not stop them from eventually getting married on March 6th, 1964. Was this important, fellas? Do we care?
Well, they just don't make scandals like that anymore. I think, you know, you look at Brad and Angelina, I guess that's as close as we've gotten in this generation. But, you know, this was like denounced from the floor of the Senate and made the headlines around the world. And yeah, when the Pope feels the need to weigh in, and you're right, Erotic Vagrancy is a great title. This was major, major stuff. None of which obviously helped Cleopatra make enough money at the box office to help to keep 20th Century Fox from selling off most of its backlot to become Century City. But yeah, this is when we talk about, like, you know, movie star romantic scandals, this is the gold standard.
Now, let me ask you this. Was this before or after Virginia Woolf?
Oh, before. Well, they didn't make Virginia Woolf until, I think, 68. Cleopatra was the first movie. Right. Like, they met on that set. They'd never worked together before.
Got it. Right. Well, if it brought them to Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, then I'm all for it, because that's quite a movie. Yes, I guess I do care about that too, because life is full of quantum. I call it quantum mechanics. And if anything in the world changed ever, everything that we're dealing with right this second would be different. I mean, maybe there would be no coronavirus. Maybe Hitler would have won the war. You never know. But in any case, I'm going to say I do care about this divorce. I think it was really important to the world of film.
What I hope, Barry, is that someone picks up on this and that somehow there's a headline after this is released saying Barry Sonnenfeld traces coronavirus back to Elizabeth Taylor wedding.
At least, you know what, although even better would be, I firmly believe that no analogy is worth making if you can't bring Hitler into the analogy. You're just wasting your breath. You know, if you can't say that's worse than what Hitler did to the Jews, just don't go with an analogy. So for me, either way, if coronavirus or Hitler, it's a win either way.
It's a win, yes.
Godwin's Law or go home.
Right.
Moving on. Also in 1964, the Beatles arrived in the United States, as did their album Meet the Beatles, which came out on January 20th, 1964. In February, they appeared on The Ed Sullivan Show. And in July, their debut feature, A Hard Day's Night, directed by Richard Lester, was released. Was this important? Do you care?
Well, I do care. It was another beautifully shot black and white movie. And in fact, the cinematographer of that movie was the same cinematographer as Dr. Strangelove. So that's kind of exciting.
Oh, that's
for me.
Right.
Gilbert.
He's a Brit cinematographer. He shot
Gilbert both, Taylor.
Gilbert Taylor. That's right. Yes, for me, that's why I care. You have to understand, I traded my Beatles at Shea Stadium to a kid who traded me his Dave Clark 5 at Carnegie Hall. So I gave up seeing the Beatles to see the DC 5 at Carnegie Hall. So I'm a Beatles fan, but I was more of a Dave Clark 5 fan.
Well,
embarrassing,
I know.
As a Clark, I thank you for that.
Oh, there you go.
Thank you for your Clark support. I love this because I think, you know, the more distance you gain and the more art is left as kind of ephemeral memory, people forget not just the film side of the Beatles, I think, is often shunted aside because it's obviously music is their you know, imprint on the world. But Hard Day's Night is just such a cool movie. And I loved their fall. I mean, they made such interesting films in general, and they were all so different. And the idea of musicians exploring a visual space like that was relatively new, especially they made, you know, their personality imprinting on it in such an interesting way. I really like the kind of that the intersection of music and film and also just social happening. It all just came together in such a cool way.
Yeah, I think it was Andrew Saris who called A Hard Day's Night the Citizen Kane of jukebox movies. And, you know, it feels so apart when you look at all of the other kind of films that were being cranked out to sort of take advantage of this or that musical trend at the time. You know, even though Barry's favorite band, the Dave Clark Five, did star in an early film directed by John Boorman, Having a Wild Weekend. Hard Day's Night, I think, definitely stands out as something pretty special. And that cultural moment has become such a touchstone for the boomer generation. It has spawned so many things like, you know, Zemeckis and Gales's, you know, I Want to Hold Your Hand. And I mean, like, just there's so much that's tied into what that moment of Beatlemania and the Beatles arriving in the U.S. I mean, for so many people, they kind of say, like, that's really when the 60s started. Do you think that's fair, Barry?
I would say the Beatles sort of defined the 60s for millions of us. Yes, absolutely.
Well, you just referenced a bunch of stuff I didn't know, Alonzo, so I feel all the better for hearing it. I'm just going to...
But Alonzo's just... Don't you think Alonzo has... Google open as we speak and he's cheating.
Barry, let me tell you, curious. The thing is, I know he does not. This is all in his brain and it could not be more, let's see. I don't think embarrassing for me is the word, but man, it just always makes me feel like I didn't do my homework. It just lives in his brain.
I'm very impressed.
Don't step to me, Sonnenfeld. This is my area.
Well, I'm very, very impressed. Let's see how you do with Strange Love later in the program.
Yes. Oh, fair challenge enough. Accepted. all right. So
I already know my first question. By the way, I already know my first question to Alonzo.
Oh, good.
Which, okay, I'm ready.
Save
to
it.
So, yeah.
Hold it in your hand.
Yeah.
All right. Yep. So I do have a final 1964 area for us to discuss. Those are the top 10 films, the box office of that year, which I find pretty delightful, I must say. Number one, Mary Poppins. Two, My Fair Lady. Three, Goldfinger. Four, The Carpetbaggers. Five, From Russia with Love. Six, Father Goose. Seven, A Shot in the Dark. Eight, What a Way to Go. Nine, The Unsinkable Molly Brown. And 10, The Pink Panther. Was this box office important? Do we care?
Oh, it's important for so many reasons. First of all, I love that there were two Bond movies in one year. And two
Pink Panthers.
Two Peter Sellers and two Peter Sellers movies.
Two Clouseaus,
two Clouseaus. That's when studios were making 35, 40 movies a year and all kinds of movies and None of them. Well, I guess you could say that From Russia with Love and Pink Panther were sort of sequels in a way. But I think it was incredibly important, at least to the industry, in terms of the amount of movies they were making. I loved how many comedies and musicals they were making back then. Mm. And, you know, Peter Sellers and James Bond in the 40% of the top 10. That's pretty great.
It is interesting.
You mentioned.
Oh, go ahead. I like that we find things interesting, okay. Alonzo.
I know. It's what makes the show so interesting. What's interesting about the, you mentioned the musical aspect of this. First of all, Mary Poppins beating out My Fair Lady is kind of a subtle form of shade because, of course, Julie Andrews was My Fair Lady on Broadway, famously not cast in the film. Disney gives her Mary Poppins instead, and that winds up not only being the movie that makes more money than My Fair Lady, but also wins Julie Andrews an Oscar over poor Audrey Hepburn, who was not even nominated.
Didn't she thank Jack Warner in her acceptance speech, who was the one who did not cast her in My Fair Lady? She was like, I'm up here accepting because one man was able to look at the films and make a choice, and I'd like to thank him, which I find, I mean, shade from anyone's great, but Julie Andrews, yes, please.
Oh, yeah, that's the shade that burns. So that's interesting on its own. And then also, like, Mary Poppins and, you know, The Sound of Music, which would come out the next year, set all the Hollywood studios on this course of chasing down these hugely expensive elephantine musicals, almost all of which lost money. But weirdly enough, at the same time, you've got The Unsinkable Molly Brown, which is kind of the last of the big old school MGM musicals, because by that point, the studio was really kind of coming apart at the seams and they were selling off, you know, the props and stuff. They weren't a studio all under one roof, you know, the way that, that movie studios had been at that point, where it was a factory that made the entire film on the grounds. So it's this transition period where we're getting out of the, like, Arthur Freed era, and, you know, Unsinkable Molly Brown is sort of the end of one chapter, and Mary Poppins is kind of the beginning of another one.
I will say, what was interesting to me when Alonzo and I had our dueling interestings, I find it interesting. We complain so much, or no, just people in general complain about how many sequels there are or franchises, and yet pointing out that I love that there's two James Bonds in this, or two Pink Panthers, and that those were also part of, this has been around forever. People love things that they recognize and they want to see more of.
I'm just amazed that they could get two Bond movies done within a 12-month period,
right,
because those movies are huge in terms of locations and just and scripts. I mean, now it takes 4 years just to write a Bond script.
And I think that they would never think, oh, but we're going to release two of them in a 12-month period. I mean, like, each of these movies now is treated as this event that we have to wait several years for. I can't imagine, like,
that's
catching
right.
one in February and then one in September, you know?
Absolutely. I that was thrilling to me to read that top 10 list.
Well, that counts as important and we care. I love What a Way to Go.
You know, I have a soft spot for it. It has some wacky stuff, but it's like they took a Comden and Green script and then gave it to the guy who directed The Guns of Navarone, which I think was a mistake. But, you know, what are you going to do? We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about Dr. Strangelove, just as soon as we hear from another one of the shows on Maximum Fun.
Hi, I'm Renee Colvert.
I'm Alexis Preston.
And we're the hosts of the smash hit podcast, Can I Pet Your Dog? Now, Alexis.
Yes.
We got big news.
Uh-oh.
Since last we did a promo, our dogs have become famous.
World famous.
World, like,
stars on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
Second big news.
Mm-hmm.
The reviews are in.
Mm-hmm.
Take yourself to Apple Podcasts. You know what you're going to hear? We're happy.
It's true.
We're a delight, a great distraction from the world.
I like that part a lot.
So if that's what you guys are looking for, mm-hmm. you got to check out our show. But what else can they expect?
We've got dog tech, dog news, celebrities with their dogs, all dog things.
All the dog things. So if that interests you, well, get yourself on over to Maximum Fun every Tuesday.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Alonzo Duraldi. Not in the studio with me are...
Drea Clark.
Barry Sonnenfeld.
And today we're talking about Dr. Strangelove. Drea, for the two people listening who may not have seen the film yet, could you give us a synopsis?
I will do my best, Alonzo. And I'll do it quickly. I know I'm starting with a we begin, but I won't go scene by scene, I promise. We do begin with a United States Air Force general who is issuing a nuclear attack first strike on the Soviet Union via communicating through ciphers to a plane that is somewhere near the Soviet Union, quickly realizing that perhaps this general is off his nut. The captain, there's a British captain with them, Lionel Mandrake, for some reason.
Field commander, I believe.
Oh, right. Okay. Lionel Mandrake, and he is there and discovers that basically the general has set this strike all in motion because he's insane and worried about his precious bodily fluids that he thinks the Soviets are somehow taking from him. And what this does mean is he shut off the base and from communications, and he shut off the plane that is on the path. So the plane that is going is under the direction of Major King Kong, essentially, and Slim Pickens plays him manically and wonderfully. And then the president, the generals, all of them gather in the war room to try and figure out how to stop this problem now that it's underway. And it is set into higher conflict when the Russians reveal that if indeed a nuclear strike happens, it will set off a doomsday scenario that will essentially kill the world. That is the comedy Dr. Strangelove and How I Learned to Love the Bomb.
Yeah. Lovely. Barry, in your book, Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother, you mentioned that you were not a big film goer as a kid, but then you also mentioned that this is then and now your favorite movie. So tell us about your history with the film and why you picked it to talk about today.
Right. I remember hearing about Dr. Strangelove when my father and some of his friends were playing Pinochle and were talking about how great it was. And I actually went to see it. I loved it then. It's still my favorite movie. For me, it represents everything that works about comedy. I know it sounds strange to talk about the end of the world as a comedy, but the secret to any comedy is not to let anyone working on the film know you're working on a comedy. You don't want the wardrobe person to know, or the wardrobe will be too wacky. You don't want the film lab to know it will be too bright. You don't want the cameraman to know you're working on a comedy. And you definitely don't want the actors to know. And what's great about this movie is, you know, we'll talk about it later. I'm sure I do have a few seconds of problems with George C. Scott, where he's being slightly too funny. But you look at Sterling Hayden and you look at Peter Sellers in those great scenes that play out in master shots and two shots with very little coverage. To me, that's the definition of comedy, which is two shots are comedy. You see action and reaction in the same shot. You hear Sterling Hayden going on and on about precious bodily fluids and fluoridation, and you see Peter Sellers in the same shot reacting. And that is the definition of comedy for me. So I just love this movie.
The legend behind the film is that they took this novel and tried to do a straightforward adaptation, and because of the life or death stakes and the scenario of mutually assured destruction, that Kubrick and his collaborators ultimately decided that there was no way to handle this material and not make it funny because it was so absurd on its face. And I don't know if that's true or not, but I think that definitely plays out in how they're presenting the material.
Well, I did read that it started out not as a comedy, although since Terry Southern is one of the writers on it, that's sort of surprising. The other thing, although maybe he came on later, you know, I think it came out within 6 weeks of Failsafe,
yes,
which is almost the same movie, not a comedy. So it's very interesting that the two were, I mean, it was on everyone's mind. It was in the sort of social atmosphere. But Kubrick could not have done a better job directing this movie. And there are comedy callbacks. So Alonzo, you want to hear the first comedy callback?
Yes.
This is going to challenge you. I think you're going to get it, but I'm going to challenge you anyway. In the opening scene of the movie, we have George C. Scott. He's off camera in the bathroom, and we're below the Pentagon in a strange motel room or something, or some bedroom with way too many mirrors. And it's amazing. Again, the whole scene plays out in one shot. There's no coverage. And the woman who answers the phone, who Scott is obviously having an affair with, appears later in the movie. Yes.
I think I know this. I think it's the actress is the only woman in this film, which is why I noted her, because she also appears later on the cover of the Playboy.
Oh,
well, actually,
my.
She's the centerfold in Playboy, and Slim Pickens is looking at the Playboy while flying his B-52, and she has a copy of Foreign Affairs covering her derriere. So I just love that. I'll tell you something else. One thing I try to do in almost every movie, both as a cinematographer and as a director, is put either the recall code, OPEPOE, it's on like a bathroom wall or somewhere as graffiti. And also I put CRM 114, which is the device that accepts the code on the airplane, is called the CRM-114 discriminator. And so like in Men in Black 3, when in the opening scene where Boris the animal is up in the moon jail, I stenciled CRM-114 on some of the walls. And on Raising Arizona, there's a scene where, I know we're not talking about Strangelove, but there's a scene where Goodman and Bill Forsythe go into a bathroom to put pomade on their hair, and it says OPEOPOE, and I reversed it so it reads the same way whether you see it in the mirror or an objective shot, because I wanted everyone to see OPEPOE.
Funny.
So RV has it. Robin Williams goes to the bathroom. So as many places as possible. Like, just like there are certain actors, I read a script and I go, where's the part for Patrick Warburton? You know, I want to work with them all. In the same way, I'll go, where am I going to put OPEPOE
in
this
awesome
movie?
That's awesome. Both this and Failsafe were coming out the Cuban Missile Crisis had not happened that long beforehand. So I think, you know, we think about the Cold War kind of having ebbs and flows. Certainly in the early 60s, the idea of just how close we were to, you know, these kind of nuclear gamesmanship toe-to-toe moments certainly must have weighed on the mind of viewers.
Yeah. But Kubrick managed to pull off a comedy about it, which is pretty amazing. I was going to say, I'm not looking forward to the coronavirus comedy, for instance.
Well, not with Kubrick not around to make it. Why do you think that Kubrick didn't go back to this well? I mean, this is still relatively early in his career. It wasn't like he had a set path in front of him. How did he never decide to like make something that was this sort of overtly a comedy again?
You know, I don't know. You know, what was he averaging? A movie every 7 years? There aren't that many movies. I will tell you a funny story about... what's the movie with D'Onofrio?
Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah. Vincent D'Onofrio was Edgar the Bug in the first Men in Black.
Oh, right.
So I asked him a million questions about Kubrick because, you know, as I said, Kubrick's my favorite director. And Kubrick made D'Onofrio come out to London. And once a week, D'Onofrio was picked up by Kubrick's car, brought out to Kubrick's estate, and Kubrick would look at him and say, gain more weight, come see me in another week. A week later, Vincent would go out, Kubrick would look at him, gain more weight. This went on for literally a couple of months. And finally, Vincent went out there and Kubrick said, great, that's the weight you should maintain. That's where I want you. And Vincent said to Kubrick, okay, now that we got that out of the way, and this is after months, can we talk about my character? And Kubrick said, you're the actor, that's your job. And gave him no direction. And in fact, the thing everyone reads about Kubrick is he'll do 100 takes of everything. And the reason he does 100 takes is very specifically, he doesn't state it, but the reason is that he thinks that if he does that many takes, the actors will get so tired, they'll be so bored, they'll be so frustrated that they'll just say the lines without acting. And that's what he's looking for. My version of that is I just say to the actors, that was great, now let's do one twice as fast. My theory is if actors are forced to talk quickly, they don't have any time to act. So I could have saved Kubrick 87 takes, 93 takes of every shot if I was only there to say, Stanley, just tell him to do it faster and you won't see the acting. Bill Pope, who was the cinematographer on Men in Black 3, was also the cinematographer on the Matrix movies, and the Wachowskis did the same thing. They would do 100 takes for the same reason, which was to try to get the acting out of the actors. Bill would light a set and then go to sleep and wait to be woken to light the next setup. So it's one way to work, but it's not the most efficient.
So before we wrap this up, I'm just kind of curious about how you think this movie fits into your overall aesthetic in terms of, you know, I mean, not just clearly, you know, not announcing your comedy intentions to the world, but if there are other films that when you watch this film, are there other things where you feel like that have been takeaways for you, whether as a cinematographer or as a director?
Yeah, well, it's two things. One we talked about, which is don't acknowledge you're making a comedy. The best example of that for me in my work is Get Shorty. I remember when we had a table read and I went to Gene Hackman, and who was at the table read before we even got a green light, before we had a studio, we just wanted to read the script. And I told Gene, if we ever got the financing for this movie, I'd love him to do it because he was so funny. And he said, I'm not a fucking comedian, or I'm not a comedian. And I said, well, that's why you're so funny, because you're not a comedian. He said, I don't know what you're talking about. But he did the movie. He's incredibly funny. Yes. Dennis Farina is incredibly funny. And again, because they're not trying to be funny. And the other takeaway from strange love of it all is that you can make a comedy that's visually arresting.
This is true.
And, you know, I hope that my comedies, whether it's the two Addams Family movies or the Three Men in Blacks or RV even, or, Get Shorty, are visually good looking, you know, and few comedies are. It used to be, you know, you would shine a light into the ceiling to get an exposure so the actors could walk wherever they want and you would be lit. But that's not my theory, and that's surely not what Kubrick was doing. It's beautifully lit and designed. And Ken Adams, who designed Strange Love, also did Addams Family for me. And in fact, Pablo Ferro, who did the titles on Strange Love, I hired Pablo. I said, just duplicate what you did in Strange Love. And the two Addams Families and the Three Men in Blacks all were Pablo just, you know, doing the same skinny little
totally, it is.
Totally, because of Strange Love.
I never thought of that, I can see that font or the typography in my head. That's so cool.
I just watched Stop Making Sense again on Criterion Channel, and I think you did those titles as well.
Same thing, that's right.
Fascinating.
And a great movie, by the way, that Demi directed.
Oh, absolutely.
Stop Making Sense, yeah.
So, Barry, on this show, for our final review for films, we categorize them that we would screen it, stream it, or skip it. So for Stanley Kubrick's 1964 Dr. Strangelove, what do you say?
I would recommend going to a movie theater to see Strangelove. it because you want to be with other people hearing them laughing.
Well, that will happen again one day. I can only hope that it will. Drea?
I'm also a Screen It, and one of my best experiences, I've seen this film a handful of times, and one of my favorites was I saw it, they do outdoor screenings at the cemetery in Hollywood, and it was just a unique enough environment, and everyone was into it and laughing at the right moments, and it's like I understood the movie better that time somehow, seeing it with the crowd. But yeah, I think this one is, I mean, it is revered for a reason, and it stands up, and it's just, it's good in so many ways. Enjoyable good, but also filmmaking nerdery good.
Yeah, I will. I'll go unanimous on Screen It. It is one of those rare films that is sort of, you know, important and must see viewing, but also super entertaining and always funny. And, you know, a kind of classic example of finding humor in something that should not and is not funny, you know, and so to sort of unpack the absurdity that is the underlying tension of, you know, the fact that very flawed individuals hold in their hands the ability to, you know, wipe out all life on Earth is terrifying, but it's also funny, and they figure out a way to make it both in this movie. But as terrifying as any of it gets, it's never not funny, so it's a work of genius. We'll be right back after we hear from another show from Maximum Fun.
Hey, I'm Dan McCoy.
I'm Stuart Wellington.
And I'm Elliot Kalin. Together, we're The Flophouse,
a podcast where we watch a bad movie and then talk about it.
Movies like Space Hobos, Into the Outer Reaches of the Unknown and the Things That We Don't Know, the movie, and also Who's That Grandma?
Zazzle Zippers, Breakdown 2, and Backhanded Compliment.
Elvis is a Policeman.
Baby Crocodile, and the Happy Twins.
Leftover Potatoes?
Station Wagon 3.
Herbie Goes to Hell.
New episodes available every other Saturday.
Available at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bye! Bye.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Alonzo Duraldi, and not in the studio with me are...
Barry Sonnenfeld.
Drea Clark.
So we are delighted to have with us the acclaimed Barry Sonnenfeld, and this is our moment to have a chat and talk to Barry about his hilarious and I could not put it down new book, Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother, Memoirs of a Neurotic Filmmaker. Barry, you were a photographer, then a cinematographer, and then then a filmmaker. But as a writer, when did that kick in?
It's funny, you know, I was very happy as a cinematographer until Scott Rudin made me become a director. I was very happy as a director until one day my neighbor in Telluride, Jerry Seinfeld, came up to my house. He had heard horror stories about making Men in Black 3 and how I didn't get along with the studio and the producers, and there were lots of problems. And he said, you know, you should really... do stand up. And I said, why? He said, because there's no one telling you what to do. You fail or succeed based on your own abilities. You don't have people, you know, standing over your shoulder. And I said, aren't I too old to be a stand up? And he said, oh, yeah, you're way too old. You won't make any money, but you'll have fun. So the closest I could come to that, because I really didn't feel comfortable standing up and having people not think I'm funny or, you know, failing, was to write this book, which is called, as you said, Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother, which is half about growing up with my crazy narcissistic parents, and half the latter half is some of my equally surreal experiences in the film business.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, we've all at some point or other read a lot of Hollywood memoirs, and it's usually, you know, there's kind of a path that you're expecting, but, you know, you give us a plane crash in the first 60 pages, and you don't get to Blood Simple till chapter 25. So it's like, okay, I don't know where we're going, but I'm in for this, whatever the ride's going to be.
Yeah, you know, the plane crash, actually happened. You know, I've always been afraid of flying. I tell people when I get off an airplane, I view it as a failed suicide attempt. And I think what started that was the very first plane I was on with my mother and father. My mother was convinced she was having an angina attack and somehow convinced the pilots. And this was on a Mexican airline leased by Eastern Airlines to fly us from New York to Miami, convinced the pilots they had to drop all the oxygen masks so that she could suck oxygen as we were flying down to Florida. So I think that was what started my fear of flying. And then in 1999, I was in a plane crash in Van Nuys Airport where the private jet I was on destroyed five parked airplanes, a fence, a Dodge Ram 3500 dually. We eventually came to a stop, and the crew, pilot, co-pilot, and flight attendant fled the plane, leaving me on the plane alone. So that's another example of surrealness in my life.
I found something really fascinating while I was reading it, and actually having forgotten your involvement with the entity I'm about to mention. But strangely, a lot of this was reminding me of Lemony Snicket's A Series of Unfortunate Events, the stories of your childhood, because of it's, you know, it's short form and there's all these things happening. But there was also so much about in A Series of Unfortunate Events, it's these kids who've been orphaned and there's a whole mystery around them. But it's also literal terrible things are happening, and at the heart of so much of it are adults either not behaving like adults should or not believing them. Or I just remember getting very frustrated, and then I remembered, oh, and Barry Sonnenfeld directed a huge chunk of that show and executive produces it. Did you, when you read A Series of Unfortunate Events, was any of that like, oh yeah, I'm like a Baudelaire basically?
Oh, absolutely. I'm very impressed that you got that. In fact, I read the books to my daughter, Chloe, and then years later, I was hired to direct the feature, and that didn't work out. And then when I heard that Netflix was doing a television show, I worked very hard to get an interview. I told them exactly how I wanted to shoot it. And for me, what I love about the books and the Netflix series, A Series of Unfortunate Events, is that what Daniel Handler, the writer, he's, quote, Lemony Snicket, posits is that children are capable and wonderful, and all adults, whether they're villains or they mean well, are equally ineffectual. And that was my parents. So for me, reading those books was like reading an autobiography. It was reading the biography.
Once again, the book is Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother. It's out now from Hachette Press, wherever fine books are sold. And it is such a great read, Barry. Congratulations. It's a really terrific
book. Well, thanks. Thanks, Alonzo. Thanks, Treya. I'm so thankful that you read the book. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it was our pleasure. So now we come to the staff picks segment of the program, where we pick any movie, but because it's a retro rewind episode, we're looking for movies from or around the year 1964. Barry, why don't you kick us off?
I'm going with 2001, A Space Odyssey. I know that's 68, but we're still in the realm of Kubrick. In the same way Kubrick, for me, created the most perfect comedy, to this day, every science fiction movie that takes place in outer space uses Kubrick's visual logic. Every wall, every spinning thing, it's all based on that movie. There's not a science fiction movie that takes place in outer space that doesn't use the visual language that Kubrick created. And it was just incredibly modern for its time, even though it was shot in a very old-fashioned way. You know, he had no visual effects. He would shoot elements and leave it in the film and then come back to another element 4 months later and put the same film back in the cameras. So there are very few opticals in that movie. It's shocking how that movie was made. It's extraordinary. So for me, I'm going to go with 2001 and stick with my man Stanley.
It's like when you talk about using an actual hand on Adam's Family and not a digital.
Yes,
<box. laughs>
exactly. Yeah.
Shooting in camera. I am going to, my selection is one that I cut Alonzo off from disparaging earlier, and that is What a Way to Go, also from 1964. This movie is something that I think could be a very enjoyable escapist little romp right now. It stars Shirley MacLaine as a woman who keeps marrying for love, and then the men become fantastically rich and their love dies, and then the men do. And she has six different male leads in this that she marries, then include Paul Newman, Robert Mitchum, Dean Martin, Gene Kelly, Bob Cummings, and Dick Van Dyke. It is the smorgasbord. It's like she's dating all of the Ocean's 11. She's dating Ocean 6, essentially. And I love it. It's fabulous. It has these, there's some musical sequences. It's super vibrant. Edith Head has put the most fantastical, ridiculous clothing on Shirley MacLaine, who's just stunning. It's nice and ridiculous, and I think would just be a wonderful, hopefully only an hour and a half, because that's as long Barry would give it, but it could be a little longer. That's my pick. What a way to go.
It's a fun bit of fluff, and there's a great running gag where she imagines each relationship as being like a different genre of film, whether it's Italian, yes, neorealist or, you know, a big budget musical. So yeah, that's a lot of fun. Mine is a 1964 title as well. It is Roger Corman's Mask of the Red Death, currently streaming on Shudder. I don't know, a movie about rich people who think that being cruel and building a wall against a plague seems like it might be, I don't know, a little timely right now. So why not? of the AIP Edgar Allan Poe movies, it's the most sort of visually striking, I think. Before we go, we're going to read a 5-star review. Hey, leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It does help us, and we will read it on the air. This week from Katie Keeps It Short. She says, Who Shot Ya is fun, energetic, relevant, and filled with so much fun content every week that I'm actually sad when it's over. I wish you all could make 2 podcasts a week. Thanks for fighting the good fight in Hollywood. Well, thank you, Katie. We appreciate it short. We're never going to do 2 a week, but we love that you want us to. That's lovely. Barry, again, thank you so much for joining us. What would you like to plug, sir?
I'm going to plug my book, Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother. If you really want an experience, you can also download the audible.com version. And if you loved or were frightened by my voice today, you can listen to 10 more hours of it by listening to the book or buying it on Kindle or the hardcover.
So, hey, next week we're going to be talking about The Hunt, which Universal is making available for streaming starting on Friday when this episode drops, along with Emma and the Invisible Man, since the theaters are all closing. It's giving you a chance to see those movies, so you can get caught up before we talk about it next time. The number, again, for the Who Shot line, we are still taking your questions, is WSY8031664. And just a quick reminder that you can buy a Jumbotron on our show, announce your engagement or your new business plans or whatever the heck you want. Go to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at WhoShotYaPod. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/WhoShotYaPodcast. Or send us an email at WhoShotYa@MaximumFun.org. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. This is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.